The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, we keep hearing this repeating theme in Europe, including if you listen to our show. I mean, let's face it, we've been talking a lot about Europe, but the repeating theme is, are we going to default? Or is austerity going to work? Where's the next bailout going to come from? I mean, look at China. China seems to step in almost like a superhero right at the last minute and say, oh, well, we're just going to go ahead and bail out Europe one more time. Is this repeating theme going anywhere, or is this just going to continue ad infinitum?
Kevin, it's kind of the death of a thousand cuts. You're looking at policymakers experimenting with things that they've experimented with already, and right. They've failed over and over and over again. But that doesn't keep them from doing what Einstein thought was utter insanity. If something doesn't work, you just have to stop it. Don't continue to punish yourself with insanity. Kevin, there's nothing in Europe that we haven't already discussed up to this point. The emergent crisis 18 months ago was a part of our conversation then. We included a detailed discussion with the European Central Bank co-founder, Otmar Issing, in an attempt to bring sort of an aerial view to the things happening there on the ground in Europe, at that point in a very developmental stage. And I sometimes feel like the issues, as you mentioned, we're looking at them over and over and over again. My hope is that we're not just aimlessly repeating ourselves.
Sure.
Maybe it is that we're searching for nuance and the differences in perspective in order to aid whether it's our listeners or clients, in a decision-making process. Kevin, the end goal is for people to understand the times. The end goal is for people to take perspicacious or wise action and be in a position where they can both preserve value, preserve assets, and see them grow. And so again, we look at Europe because that is what is front and center today.
Well, and David, we've had Bill King on a number of times as a guest, and he outlines just a simple continually repeating theme that we probably need to understand overlays as a structure what we're seeing in Europe. His quote is, nations first try to inflate over their debt, then they seek bailouts that are contingent on austerity plans. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? But the austerity causes the economy to sink, impairing the ability to service debt. Citizens then violently protest the austerity measures, so countries then default and restructure the debt. Now, that last step we have not gotten to. We get right to the edge of this Greek default. In fact, 98% chance of a Greek default, according to the credit markets at this point.
Exactly,
right?
Up from a 91% chance on Friday. So it's a daily deterioration, Kevin, and I think imminent has to be the word of the week with an I, not an A or an E. But these are interesting times, Kevin, as we watch materialize in real time something that's restructuring Europe as we know it, and potentially U.S. European relationships via the currency relationship in the capital markets. We've got the British who are talking about completely restructuring their banks and it doing, frankly, what we described in conversation with Larry Kotlikoff not long ago, basically ring-fencing the vital parts of the bank and allowing the speculative trade desks and whatnot to be spun off or run separately with the risk managed very differently. So there's a reconstructive process happening, Kevin, behind the scenes, and it's a very tricky situation for investors to be in, certainly one where you need to keep your eyes and ears very much open.
Well, and when we talk about these overlaying structures, these patterns, and you've seen three of four steps, and you know that the fourth step comes, like in this particular case, countries then default and restructure their debt. That is a fourth step in this process. I think about a couple of weeks ago, my daughter lives in Manhattan, and the forecast about a week before was that Hurricane Irene was going to come in. I was going to go visit her anyway, but we actually moved the ticket up because when you know a storm is coming, you prepare. And, New York was not ready for a large storm. And, thank the Lord, it really passed over New York, but it could have been a horrible disaster. But, it was interesting watching people prepare. Most people in New York really didn't do a thing about it until hours before they heard the stores were going to close and the subways were going to shut down. Then all of a sudden, people started buying bottles of water and tuna. Wouldn't have gotten them very long. I'm wondering if the Europeans right now are prepared for what's just about to happen?
Well, Kevin, I think the Germans are certainly trying to limit what would be the fallout from major structural changes within the EMU, with membership changing potentially even within days. When you know a storm is coming, Kevin, you're right, you prepare, and Germany's chosen to anticipate the worst. They're putting together a plan as we speak to aid their banks, and they're assuming a default in Greece. So they're now moving into, not triage because the event has not occurred, but in anticipation. Do we have the supplies we need?
So the question is not if, but when at this point for Germany anyway.
Exactly. And they need to soften the blows for the banks because the banks serve as a conduit of liquidity. The banks serve the economy as sort of the connecting point. They're prized more critically than any other industry, particularly in this type of crisis.
Well, it sounds like the United States. We prized our banks more than anything else back in 2008.
You know, we're on the cusp of an official default. And what that means is that you'll see a write-down or a marking down of assets on bank balance sheets to reflect the already depreciated assets they hold. This is something that most people may not be aware of.
Right.
But if you hold something to maturity, you can continue for accounting purposes to treat it as if it is a full value asset as opposed to something that's been impaired or something that has lost value in the interim. So when that default occurs, there is an immediate marking down of that paper. It's no longer treated as a held to maturity asset.
So now let me make sure I understand what you're saying. When you give your kids savings bonds, it would be as if they were counting the end maturity value the whole time as
exactly.
The full amount.
Yeah, even if it's trading at a discount. And of course, the Greek paper is trading at an extreme discount today. So a default prices the asset immediately. And in the case of the Greek paper we're talking about, it implies a 50% loss or more by the assets held. This is different from institution to institution. You have certain institutions that hold that sovereign paper on their balance sheet. And then you also have institutions that have branch banks in Greece, which is a different kind of Greek exposure. So, yeah, particularly when you're looking at the French banks, you've got some that actually have branches, as I mentioned, and some like a BNP that just are chock full of the Greek debt itself.
Well, and, you know, it's not just the Greek debt. You know, since you're bringing up Greeks, we may as well go back to an ancient Greek who said, give me a lever long enough and I can move the world. I mean, the issue is leverage, right?
No, the issue is clearly leverage because banks profit themselves and they profit their shareholders by enhancing their returns via leveraging the assets they have.
Right.
Investments that they have exceed the actual bank capital. And that allows them to see growth as long as they have an environment, an economic environment that is supportive to those assets appreciating. But that's the problem. If the assets go down instead, your losses can exceed the entirety of bank capital.
That's called bankruptcy, Dave.
That's correct. I mean, and so you have to avoid bankruptcy for these financial institutions. Governments have, as we've seen 2008 to the present, and are at present committing larger and larger amounts of funds to supplement bank capital. It's all well and good to say to a bank via Basel II, Basel III, what have you, you need to raise the amount of capital that you have. Well, raising capital is difficult to do in a stressed environment. You're basically going to the general public and saying, will you give me an IOU or will you be an investor in my bank? We'll look at this in a minute, Kevin, but we're watching banks in the European context, which have lost 40, 50, 60% of their equity value since the middle of the summer. I mean, just in the last few months. So this is a challenged effort. You can't go to the general public and say, please extend a loan, will you? We're good for it because you're now in an environment. Actually, this is exactly like what bankers do to us.
Right.
When you don't need money, they are there to give you all that you want on friendly terms. And when you need money, oh, no, 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 you cannot have our precious capital. So it's just being played in reverse. This is why governments are so involved, because the market says, no, bad bet, not interested, can't have my hard-earned money. So the government steps in for the sake of preserving normalcy and market stability, and it is pledging to support bank capital.
Okay, but David, there are strange beneficiaries to these types of crises. I mean, if you owned the printing presses or the company that prints currencies, these guys are printing like there's no tomorrow, are they not? I mean, isn't there a printer in Europe right now that's doing quite well? Well, they're very busy.
It's a classic business model, Kevin. I mean, you think of the Gutenberg printing press, you think of all the things, the good things that have come from printing presses, and there are many good things that have come from printing presses. The things that aren't necessarily advantageous or attractive all seem to come from De La Rue. De La Rue is the British printer that's been responsible for printing currencies for over 150 different countries around the world.
So the question is, oh, you want more currency? Just put your order in.
Now, of course, Kevin, when we're talking about the support to the banking industry, we're really talking about digital credits and debits.
Sure.
So, but what's interesting, Kevin, is it's already being rumored that a European currency has already been printed. ? Who is that?
So are you being conspiratorial, or is this, how strong is this rumor?
Not at all. I think if you look at the Greek leadership and they know that default is inevitable, that's not necessarily how they're going to posture in front of the press. They will keep their game face on until the very last minute.
But it's how they'll posture in front of the printing press.
Well, that's what's next, is to say, you know, unfortunately, we have had to make other arrangements and will no longer be EMU participants.
Well, Dave, I have a question, though, because the European Union, the backbone of the European Union, was supposed to be founded on German integrity, German discipline, Bundesbank background. You know, even when we talk to Otmar Issing, these guys don't want to see inflation. And what we're talking about is inflationary.
Well, it is inflationary, and we're talking about specifically in the Greek context. But if you look at the original exchange rates, as any of these peripheral countries came into the EMU,
right,
you look at the exchange rate that they had, and it was hundreds to one, implying that they had been irresponsible with their inflation rates for decades. This is par for the course.
So, David, Athens Airport is still operating. I mean, there are reporters coming in right now to report what could be an imminent event. Are there other planes that are maybe stuffed full of currency?
Kevin, this is the rumor. The rumor is that you've already printed the money. I don't know if it's drachma. I don't know what they're going to call it. But if they break from the EMU, it is to eliminate the debt burden, and they can do that via printing.
Sure.
We'll pay you back every dollar. It's just going to be with a depreciating piece of paper. We're back to the classic version of devaluation. We're back to the classic version of default, not the kind that they're being forced to the brink of. They may very well default and have to make partial payments.
But this is more South American.
This is more of a South American kind of default, where you just print and pay and print and pay and print and pay. And yeah, it may actually be a more North American version, as we're doing the same thing. But what they are regaining is monetary sovereignty if they in fact leave the EMU. That's what they gave up when they entered the Union. Potentially, Kevin, at the Athens airport, you may see transports delivering currency over the next few weeks. We're not positive, but we do know that change is imminent.
Well, David, going back to Bundesbank, we interviewed Otmar Issing last year, and we talked about the discipline of the background that the Germans had faced and how they didn't want to go through that again. Bundesbank and German mentality has played very much into the European Central Bank at this point. Is that still the case?
Well, that's what seems to be changing, Kevin. And I think if there's anything of grave significance in Europe in the last 10 days, it's not what's happening with Greece. That's attention getting because it's in the news and it defines something that is more of a spectacle, but something that we've been predicting and seeing for some time. Seeing Jürgen Stark resign last week as one of the key principals at the European Central Bank.
He was a Bundesbank guy in the past.
Exactly. And he represented a voice. He represented a voice that brought stability, that was a sort of an anchor, if you will. So, you know, he says he resigned for personal reasons, and that's fine. But 3 years ahead of his term ending, mm-hmm, in the midst of utter chaos within the European context,
right,
after last week being in direct conflict with other members of the ECB over the renewed purchase of European bonds. I mean, they've been doing this now for a couple of weeks, specifically with Spanish and Italian paper, and they're driving the yields down, purchasing these bonds as they're issued, and having some success in doing that. But, Kevin, this has been the problem. The Bundesbank judgment is, when you monetize, you will create inflation.
We've seen it before.
Our job, yep, as central bankers is to look at inflation very carefully. Price stability is a mandate. It's a critical mandate. Unlike the U.S., they don't have the dual mandate of price stability and full employment. So they're focusing on price stability and saying, no, what you are doing is putting into the pipeline a degree of inflation which we will not be able to contain. We disapprove of the monetization of this debt. Otmar Issing, from the sidelines, has been more and more critical,
right,
of what the ECB is doing in support of the rest of Europe and the European debt markets. Because, and again, this is what we talked about last week, Kevin, it's because what is implied is a quasi-fiscal union. If one entity is now supporting the debt structure of all these individual countries. That was not supposed to be. Now, maybe it was desired from behind the scenes. We don't know. But we know that the original agreement was a monetary union only. Monetary union, not a fiscal union. With Jürgen Stark leaving, Kevin, you really don't have a counterweight to someone like Trichet. You don't have a counterweight, frankly, to someone like Mario Draghi.
Well, this is what I'm asking. Granted, he may not act like an Italian, but he's got an Italian name, and isn't Italy the issue right now?
No, that actually argues for him taking more of a hawkish view to inflation and being less accommodative.
Because he doesn't want to look like an Italian.
Exactly. I may be an Italian, I may be a Goldman man, right. But don't paint me into that corner. I can do the right thing. We'll see how long he can do the right thing. This is the issue, Kevin. Draghi takes the reins at the ECB from Trichet November 1st, and, you know, will his policies be as accommodative? Will he be as interventionist as Trichet has been?
Mm-hmm.
Likely, but with caveats. He needs to protect himself because there is some suspicion relating to his home country and perhaps loyalties therein. Kevin, the question is, the former Goldman man, can he prioritize European stability, or will he ultimately be taking calls from his Goldman cohorts to sort of discuss who thrives and who fails over the next 2 to 4 years in the Eurozone?
Now, Dave, are you accusing Goldman Sachs of possibly front-running or getting inside information or possibly even manipulating a situation for a particular outcome and winning on the bet?
They have Rolodexes, which are impeccably designed and probably kept under lock and key. This implies nothing, Kevin. They are not ever doing things that are clever.
They're doing God's work. Isn't that what we heard last year?
Goldman Sachs. Kevin, this is the issue. They're so well-placed. You're talking about professional discussions amongst fellow bank CEOs and G20 leaders. So, you know, these things have to be discussed in order to prevent there being disorderly chaos in the marketplace.
Right.
So, no, we're not discussing these amongst ourselves to then go have weekend soirees and figure out how we'll personally trade against it or trade for it. No, we're not determining who's going to be going long or who's going to be going short, taking positions in light of what, you know, our friend Draghi might be telling us. No, I don't think we can assume that Goldman will be doing any of that or Draghi would be participating. He is a man above reproach, as we found all Goldman men to be.
Just a reminder, you're listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com. Feel free to go ahead and send your questions in. It's time this fall to start answering our listeners' questions again, and you can send those to McIlvaney at McIlvaney.com. Let's get to the crux of the matter then on the EMU. Let's just try to think ahead a little bit. Let's say, all right, we can get into a time machine, go forward a few weeks, a few months, maybe a couple of years. Where are the EMU participants going?
Well, I mean, the crux is that they have to either move to fiscal union. That's the first option.
Okay.
Or they can consolidate around a smaller core. And a successful Eurozone at this juncture would essentially be, remember the credit market adjustments that took place as individual countries joined the euro, and they saw their credit ratings improve,
mm-hmm.
they saw their credit costs decline. And what was that in light of? What was that in light of?
Well, it was basically because Germany was involved.
Well, exactly. So they had the benefit by proxy of being related to Germany. The recently proposed Eurobond carried the same mark of German credit. I mean, that's why people were thinking this is an interesting solution. The problem was that it was an implicit fiscal union, and therefore, you know, on the basis of a referendum vote, was not likely to be approved. This idea of fiscal union is very unpopular. The question is, can the folks who are so for the Eurozone, can they get it pulled off without a referendum?
Well, and David, we've talked before about the price of gold telling the truth on leaders, but so does the interest rate spread between different types of bonds. Now, in the beginning, they were actually giving the rest of Europe the benefit of the doubt based on Germany being there. But aren't interest rates starting to tell a different tale?
Well, over the last 12 to 18 months, we've watched the spread between German bonds, the difference between German bonds and other European paper, widen further and further, which it's just acknowledging the actual balance sheet differences that exist between your various European states. And just to reiterate, there's really only two choices that exist. You've got fiscal union on the one hand, or a shrinking membership role. And a number of countries would be leaving of their own accord, not pressured out, but leaving of their own accord, preserving the EMU and allowing it even to become a better currency alternative on the open market.
Well, okay, so if you had to take a bet one way or another right now, is fiscal union on the horizon, or are we going to see this consolidation and it stay monetary union?
Well, I think a fiscal union is possible as long as it avoids a public vote, because that would never pass.
Right.
It would never pass muster. So you're talking now about the cigar-filled, you know, oak-lined panel where men are making, women are making decisions behind the scenes, and we have approved for your benefit the future of Europe. And, you know, the Lisbon Treaty is a part of this, Kevin. I mean, it can't go that way.
Right.
Unless it's done surreptitiously.
So, David, whatever happens, they're going to have to find a way of increasing efficiency to continue to move. They're completely immobile at this point.
Well, if they scrape the barnacles off the bottom of the boat, they'll find that efficiency. And that's essentially taking the peripheral countries out or voluntarily letting them leave. This is an interesting thing, Kevin, because a lot of your power-hungry folks in Europe, I mean, we're talking about the true socialist elite,
right,
they don't want to concede defeat in any part. And they're using very strong language. I mean, the term irrevocable, the commitment to the EMU, it was voluntary up front.
Yeah, when did it become irrevocable?
Well, that's what's interesting. They're saying the treaty signed cannot be undone. I don't think we've got the complexity there in Europe that you had with sort of the Federalist North and the states' rights South here in the United States several hundred years ago.
Yeah.
But you do have this strange no. We're in control, and you may not leave. We're not approving that.
David, it's Hotel California. You can check in, but you can never leave.
Well, and I don't know what's going to happen, Kevin. Nobody does know what's going to happen. But we do know that there's advantages to being able to inflate away your debt. We do know that politically, austerity measures are death to the existing parties in power. You can't tell the Greeks that they're going to be the ones that suffer.
Right.
You can't tell them that and expect to be reelected. That's what we're seeing fall apart. It's political chaos, because the only thing that the Greek government can do is put in place austerity measures, fiscal measures. They lost their monetary tools. The contrast between us and them is so significant, because we can bandy about different fiscal measures. We can talk about the jobs creation program last week.
And then we can just print reserve currency.
And then we can just print and print and print, and when we can pretend to try to solve the problem. Kevin, what's the cost of Obama's new jobs program?
$477 billion amongst friends.
Well, let's just round it.
If it's already paid for.
I know. Well, that's what he said originally, but it actually looks more like a $421 billion tax hike.
Oh, so it wasn't already paid.
No. If you look at it, this is what drives me crazy with politicians. They can't just speak the simple truth. They have to pack it with so much ethos. They have to pack it with so much pathos. You feel guilty. I'm abusing elderly and young children if I don't approve this jobs program. Kevin, $477 billion?
Yeah.
And he thinks he's going to create 500,000 to 2 million jobs. That's $1 million per job create, $1 million per job created, or if he does actually create 2 million jobs, $250 million.
Maybe we just send people millions of dollars and just say, retire.
Why don't you find 10 million people that need an extra $50,000?
Yeah.
Because it's going to end up in making its way into the economy far more effectively than the government bureaucracy trying to, quote-unquote, create jobs. Kevin, this is the insanity.
You're just a negative Nancy, Dave. You're a Debbie Downer. I'm sorry. This is the wrong way to look at it. You should be supporting your president right now.
I'd like to support the president. I'd like to support a statesman. I'd like to support leadership. I'd like to support ideas that don't have negative consequences. And, Kevin, I fear what we're facing is the ultimate demise of our American dream up and until we have adequate leadership to draw us out and through the other side.
Well, David, you're talking about how much it costs to bring just a single new job under the president's job plan, but the problem is we're also paying for jobs over in Europe. I mean, there are bailouts. We're talking about European bailouts and Germans, and we're talking about austerity, and then we're talking about the ECB having a new lease on life. But what about us? We have spent an awful lot of money, more than the Chinese, more than the Russians have, in the bailout of Europe.
Well, and this was an interesting disclosure this summer, Kevin. I mean, we found that actually we were very, very active in supporting foreign institutions in the 2008 period via the Fed swap lines.
Right.
And this is, I think, what we will see open here in the next few months, liquefying the world, the U.S. being the lender of last resort, and very ironically, the world's largest debtor in those moments of crisis also being the world's largest creditor at the same time. It's the ubiquity of our currency and the limitlessness of it that allows us to lend very short-term, overnight, via digital credits and debits. And Kevin, I think this is the stability component which the Fed has sort of scripted for itself. It is going to spend an infinite number of dollars to maintain stability in the international markets. And we have right now in front of us something that is begging for those swap lines to open. French banks are under pressure. German banks are under pressure. Why? Because of the assets that they hold via Greece. So, I mean, it's a strange web of interconnectedness, Kevin, but French banks have been under pressure since June 15th. You've had Société Générale sell off by 55%. 55%. Their stock is down 55% in a matter of months. BNP Paribas down 42%. Credit Agricole down 45% again.
Recall 2008 here in America. I mean, we're seeing these same types of things happening right now in France.
Right. And this is why we were talking about last week, Kevin, the idea that a number of these institutions will have to merge to survive. The question is, what gets them through a moment of crisis where there's panic in the marketplace and good reason to jump ship as an equity owner? Looking at insolvency, looking at your liabilities exceeding your total capital by 2, 3, 5, 10 times because your equity has been sold off so precipitously. That is why the Fed is there. The Fed is there to make sure that the world is not coming glued financially. Does this have echoes of 2008? Yes, only we're not talking about single institution stability, Kevin. We're talking about entire countries, not just singular institutions, but entire
national nation type of problem. In fact, it's a worldwide default if it's allowed to go on. But we also know that, you know, we've been joking about planes coming into Greece and replacing the currency. We've been talking about the ECB having a new lease like we talked about. We've been talking about all these things, but they're highly, highly inflationary. But let me use a different word. Currency devaluationary. Okay? In other words, the European currency has been falling in its buying power. The U.S. dollar has been falling in its buying power. You know, the only currency that really wasn't falling in its buying power was the Swiss franc until they pegged the currency last week.
To the euro.
Yeah.
To the euro. Yeah, so Kevin, I think the peg at 1.2 is an interesting scenario. I don't know that there is the resolve with the Swiss National Bank or the depth of pocket to continue to write the check and maintain that stated peg.
So what you're saying is they may print money for a while to try to keep their currency down and stay pegged to the euro, but if the euro falls too far, you think the Swiss might still break away?
Well, the question is how much money are they willing to spend in that effort, and they can ultimately destabilize their own price stability, if you will, or purchasing power in their own country. So,
but you're not going to count this as a stable hedge right now. In other words, you're not going to tell a client, hey, go buy Swiss franc, because it may still play a better hedge than another currency.
Well, here's the irony. It now stinks like all the other fiat currencies. It just happens to be a better bet than the U.S. dollar and other things that stink even worse.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's a question of lesser evils. It's not a question of greater goods. And that's where I think we come back to the gold bull market and see a duration for this market as years. Years. Why? Because this is really the point. It will endure as long as the Keynesian bias, long dominating the halls of the Fed, long dominating the halls of the Treasury, long dominating universities, as long as the Keynesian bias remains.
And the Keynesian bias is print money or change fiscal policy, but basically stay away from gold, stay away from discipline. This hits me all the time. You know, I've done this many, many years and we've talked many years, but we can spend hours talking about what currency is the best currency and what's going to happen next to this paper market or that paper market. Why is it that people avoid gold, which seems to be a natural answer? I mean, we're seeing the Europeans at this point start to compete with us as far as buying gold. We've been buying gold from Europeans for years. You know, your dad's company and now you run the company. That's where we've gotten a lot of our gold. And the Europeans are starting to finally wake up and say, well, maybe it's not in euro. Maybe it's not in U.S. dollars. And maybe after last week, it's not in Swiss franc.
Yeah, it was interesting. I when I was down in Argentina, I ran into a German family that was on vacation. And he worked for BMW, had been working for BMW for about 30 years in their HR department, and loves the company, loves the euro, loves the ease with which he can go from one country to the next. And I asked him flat out what he thought about the stability of the euro. And he said, it will always always be stable. It has to be. Nobody wants to go back to changing currencies at borders. And I'm thinking to myself, is that your only perspective? It's just an issue of convenience. I mean, there are deeper issues here. When we're talking about issues of convenience, that's one of the things that has had gold on the outside and U.S. dollars on the inside.
Sure, because you don't go to the grocery store with an ounce of gold.
Exactly. So we have these biases on the basis of patterned behavior and ease of use or convenience, which do dictate how we feel about certain asset classes. Gold, Kevin, is going to continue to remain front and center as a priority in people's portfolios as long as we have negative real rates of return. We've talked how many times about Gibson's paradox and the Summers-Barsky thesis.
Right, which is simply, if interest rates are too low and inflation's too high, it's not going to work.
Yeah, if what you're earning on your investments, what you qualify as your productive capital, right, what's supposed to be growing in terms of capital gains or providing income, if your real rate of return, after you pay your taxes and after you account for inflation, if your real rate of return is negative, strip out all the reward. Why'd you take the risk? It
right.
did not make sense. So market participants come to the conclusion, in a negative real rate environment, I'm going to opt out. At some point, I'll reengage when I can put my capital to work productively. But until that point, don't force me to take risk without reward.
Right.
Strip away the reward, and I'm just not going to play. That is the growing awareness globally, Kevin, as we see interest rate suppression, not just in the United States, but in Europe as well. We've seen the Europeans, Trichet just recently, has qualified with the most recent inflation numbers. That is largely a balanced issue. They're no longer concerned about inflation. What he's doing is trying to set Draghi up to, in the first few months of being in office, be able to lower rates below the 1.5%, and again, create that same almost zero interest rate environment we have here in the United States. It ends up driving investor interest into gold because there's a frustration. Where do you go? Where do you go when real world inflation, not the stated rate of inflation, but real world inflation is nearing double digits and taxes are on the increase because governments are desperate for revenue? You go to a place where you don't have to take risk, or at least in that environment, it's deemed as less risky than your other alternatives.
Well, David, what we've seen is about 80 years of a flawed system, the Keynesian system, start out and actually look like it was working because of other factors. But really, Keynes talks about printing worthless money, spending it, and lowering interest rates when they shouldn't be lowered. We have seen where Keynes has gone wrong. We're coming to a turning point. You know, I think back to a great interview we had last year with a man named Hunter Lewis, who wrote the book Where Keynes Went Wrong. I think maybe it would be time to revisit that.
Well, Kevin, just the discussion, because so many of Keynes's ideas are assumed to be true. It's the basis upon which our policymakers behave and act and think. And again, we never want to be construed as being disrespectful to the folks at the Fed and the Treasury. We're talking about people who earned their degrees, worked hard, stayed up late nights, drank lots of coffee, I'm sure, in putting together what they thought was sort of their personal magnum opus. The problem is, good logic, bad assumptions, ends you back with mistakes.
Right.
So we're not faulting their logic, we're faulting their assumptions, so many of which are based on the ideas of John Maynard Keynes.
That's what makes it so hard to learn economics, to be honest with you, because it doesn't make sense. I mean, Keynesian economics, it's like you can get something for nothing, money does grow on trees, and that's okay, because my parents didn't tell me that.
Well, and I think you're right, Kevin. Bringing Hunter Lewis back into the equation and having him explore with us again where Keynes went wrong, why the Europeans as well as those in the U.S. continue to sort of bow to the throne of a dead academic, you know, and are there better sets of ideas out there? Kevin, I don't know what the revolution will look like of ideas, but again, from a business standpoint, view the gold bull market as something that is limited in scope. The next 2 to 3 years, perhaps, we'll see its ultimate peak price. But when I consider how hard it is to see ideas change and the fact that we're really talking about the death of an ideology, and until that ideology or worldview changes, gold will have its place front and center, because that is in fact what's driving the price higher, is the abuse of the Keynesian system. Now you're talking about an extension of 5 to 10 years. I don't know. We need a revolution of ideas, and the part of me that likes capital gains doesn't mind seeing Keynes win the day. But the other part of me that says, I love my children, my children's children, and my children's children's children, and I want them to inherit plenty, not want, I want to see change now, and I want to see the end of the gold bull market now, because it's a better place to live. It's a better place to exist. It's a place that's based on right ideas versus ideas that just seemed intelligent when they were adopted.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. And as we asked you last week, feel free to send in your questions. We're coming into that period of time where questions are answered of our listeners on the program. We do this each fall. Those questions can be emailed to McIlvaney@McIlvaney.com, or you can give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.